Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In 1911, Ishii, the last Stone Age Indian, walked into the community of Oroville, California, opening an anthropologic window into the lives of Native Californians that remains open today. In this edition of Radio Curious, we'll visit with Professor Oren Starn, an anthropologist at Duke University and the author of Ishii's Brain, In Search of the Last Wild Indian. Although Ishii's brain and the ashes from his cremation were not repatriated and properly buried until approximately 84 years after his death, his brain carried the fascinating story of life in California as it existed for about 11,000 years until about 150 years ago. I spoke with Oren Starn from his office at Duke University and asked him to begin by describing what happened to Ishii's people during the first years of the California Gold Rush.
I think Ishii's story is an especially dramatic and unique one. In a nutshell, what had happened was that in the 1840s and 50s, white settlers were moving into the mountains and then into the valleys of California. And Ishii's people, the Yahi, were one of many California tribes living at that time. Most of the rest of his Yahi tribe was hunted down and killed in those very violent first years of the gold rush. And eventually Ishii and a couple of others went into hiding in a very remote canyon just above the Sacramento Valley, the canyon of Deer Creek. There, Ishii and these other last survivors had a kind of hideout beneath the cliffs that they called Grizzly Bear's Hiding Place. And they managed to elude capture, even detection, for almost 50 years there. At last, in 1911, Ishii was captured trying to steal a bit of meat in the slaughterhouse in a town called Oroville, north of Sacramento. And he was brought to live in the Anthropology Museum in San Francisco, which was then on Parnassus Heights, where the UC Medical Center is now located, overlooking Golden Gate Park. And he lived there for 5 years and finally passed away in 1916. The whole story of his discovery caused a media sensation at the time because it seemed that here was a man who'd walked straight out of the Stone Age, who dressed in skins, who hunted with a bow and arrow. In fact, Ishii didn't speak any English. He spoke only his native language, Yahi.
He was just one voice into a culture that no longer existed, and it was a male voice. So there's a lot that may not have been said or that would be reinterpreted had it been said by others.
That's true, and one of the things that's fascinated me about Ishii is how much we can't know about his story. We actually do know a lot. There were recordings made by the anthropologists in San Francisco of his myths. Ishii showed the anthropologist how he had lived in the wild and how he made bows and arrows and how he made acorn mush, how he had managed to survive for so many years in the wild. Yet, again, there are these mysteries and gaps in Ishii's story. For instance, the very elemental-seeming matter of his name. Ishii is not the real name of the man who lived for 40 years in the wilds of California.
Is there any reference to what he called himself?
What happened was for the Yahi people, and this is true for some other tribes in California, your personal name was a private matter. It wasn't something that you revealed to strangers. And so when Ishii came to live in San Francisco, he didn't tell anybody his personal name, and the anthropologists, among them Alfred Kroeber, who was the founder of the UC Berkeley Anthropology Department, didn't press him for his real name. And by mutual agreement, he came to be known as Ishii, which is the word in the Yahi language for man.
There's also some discrepancy about the name of the group Yahi, where that came from.
the matter of names and of tribal names is a very complicated one in Native California in general. Sometimes local groups didn't exactly have names for themselves. They simply referred to themselves by words in their own language that meant something like the people. In the case of the Yahi, Yahi just means people. And it was a name that the anthropologists came up with. It's not altogether clear that Yahi was a word that Ishi or the people that he lived with would have necessarily called themselves.
A lot of your research reflects the review and analysis that Theodora Kroeber made of her husband Alfred Kroeber's notes. Yet you point out problems in that.
Theodora Kroeber, I think, is a fascinating person in the history of California and the history of the West. She was a housewife for most of her life and only began to write in the 1950s. And her surprise, it was her second book and became a surprise bestseller, was a biography of Ishi called Ishi in Two Worlds. And this, in many ways, is a wonderful book and helped partly, I think, to rescue Ishi from a kind of obscurity that he'd fallen into in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. When Ishi came out in 1911, he was something of a national celebrity, and the newspapers covered his doings and his life of this supposedly Stone Age man in the museum. But by 1960, when Theodora Kroeber was writing, many people in California certainly had forgotten about Ishi. It was kind of a footnote, strange footnote in the history of the state. And Theodora Kroeber wrote this biography that brought Ishi back to life in a way. It was a very detailed and in some ways very powerful account of the campaign of extermination that had been waged against Ishi's Yahi people and of Ishi's life as a so-called museum Indian. And for the last 40 years, I think, Theodora Kroeber's Ishi in Two Worlds has been a Bible for Ishi studies. I and most other people who've been interested in Ishi came to know Ishi by reading that book. But one of the things that I found as I began to do research myself and to go to the archives and to poke around in old papers and to trek up into Deer Creek myself, was I came to realize some of the ways in which Theodora had made up parts of her story, had taken writerly liberties to add to the drama and pathos of Ishi's story. Dramatic story anyway. It's not altogether clear that she needed to take those liberties. But just to give you one or two examples, she described Ishi upon his capture in 1911 as dressed in an ancient scrap of covered wagon canvas. Now, we have pictures of what Ishi looked like at that point, and in fact, he was wearing a long underwear kind of thing that was known as a miner's shirt at the time, not an ancient scrap of covered wagon canvas. There wouldn't have been covered wagons in California for more than 50 years. Theodora also said that Ishi was starving and refused to eat in his first days of captivity. In fact, all of the newspaper accounts that we have suggest that he had been hungry and was happy to eat and ate well in those first few days. What I found in general was that there were ways that Theodora had written in details, events, parts of the story that served her own interest in telling the story in as dramatic and heartrending a way as possible. Again, I do think Ishi's story is dramatic and heartrending, yet the story turns out to have been more complex in a lot of ways from the one that Theodora Kroeber told in her biography.
Oren, I want you to tell us about the complexities of those stories, but before you do that, I want to mention that we're talking with Oren Starn, the author of a recent book called Ishi's Brain, In Search of America's Last Wild Indian. Oren Starn will be in Ukiah on Saturday, March 13th at the Ukiah Civic Center, where there will be a showing of Jed Riffey's documentary film, Ishi, the Last Yahi. He'll also be at the Gallery Bookstore in the Village of Mendocino on Friday night, March 12th at 7 in the evening. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Oren, tell us more about Ishi and his culture.
Well, I think that the story of Ishi and his culture is a dramatic and complicated one. One of the images that we have of Ishi and his Yahi people and this is an image that Theodore Kroeber helped to produce, is the image of Ishi's Yahi people as completely cut off from the rest of the world, as people from the Stone Age, as almost people living on another planet, as living fossils somehow tied to humankind's ancient past. And in fact, one of the things that I learned in poking around more into Ishi's story is that the story was more complex than that. That in fact, Ishi's Yahi people did have a series of interactions and contacts with the outside world. Just to give you a couple of examples, Ishi had several Spanish words in his vocabulary. For instance, his word for paper was papelo, from the Spanish paper. His word for cow was vaca, from the Spanish vaca. And this suggests the possibility that Ishi's Yahi people way back in the 1840s may have worked actually as ranch hands on some of the ranches in the northern Sacramento Valley, which was at that time Mexican California, where Spanish was spoken. Just to give you another example of what I've found to be the complexity of Ishi's story, when I made it to his hiding place, Grizzly Bear's hiding place, a couple of years ago for the first time, this is a spot on the side of a canyon in the canyon of Deer Creek above the town of Chico, the first thing that I saw there was a tin of log cabin syrup, a very old tin dating back to the 1890s that was wedged between a tree there. And what I realized, and what other archaeologists who've written about this have learned, is that in fact Ishi's people and Ishi himself were only surviving by stealing and scavenging different food items and other goods from the local white cabins. So Ishi's hiding place, even today, is littered with rusted tin cans, bottles, knives, forks, broken saw blades. Ishi and his people did know the traditional ways of their people, of the Yahi people. Ishi knew how to sing 50 songs in Yahi. He knew how to snare rabbits with milkweed. He was a skilled hunter with a bow and arrow. He knew how to harpoon salmon as they rushed up Deer Creek in the fall. But at the same time, they had and were dependent on all of these different goods that they were taking from white settlers. So in fact, Ishi's life in those long years of hiding was a very mixed and hybrid one of using both traditional ways of survival, but also adapting and incorporating these elements of Western material culture.
Tell us about Ishi's songs, of which there are recordings now, and what they reveal about the contract that Ishi's tribe had with other tribes of the foothills of the Western Sierras.
Well, we're fortunate to have very extensive sound recordings of Ishi himself singing in his own words, in his own Yahi language, of which he was the world's last speaker. We have hours and hours of recordings that were made on an early Victorola gramophone back in 1911 through 1914. Also, a linguist named Edward Sapir worked with Ishi and took down many of his myths and stories. One of the things that's interesting is that Ishi appears to have been very interested and concerned to leave a record of the mythology and the songs of his people. There's one story that I love of Ishi making a recording. Imagine he and a couple of the anthropologists in the basement of the Anthropology Museum in San Francisco in 1914. And at one point, the phone rang, and the anthropologist, Thomas Waterman, who was making the recording with Ishi, got up to answer it. When Waterman came back into the room, Ishi was very angry with him and said in the Yahi tongue, "Don't do that again." Because Ishi, for reasons that we're not altogether clear about, wanted to leave a record of the mythology, of the lore, of the traditions of his people. Almost all of the recordings that were made were in the Yahi language, and we're now able, thanks to the work of a number of different linguists, we do have translations of a number of these songs of Ishi's creation story, which involves grizzly bear, rabbit, earth maker, and the ways that they brought the world into existence. We also have songs that Ishi knew that were for the hunt, that were sung to accompany the preparation of acorns, and songs that were sung during the stick gambling games that the Yahi people would have played at nights up in the mountains. Ishii did also know, though, as you mentioned, several songs from other neighboring tribes, among them a couple of songs from the Mountain Maidu people to the southeast of his Yahi region, and ones of the Wintu who lived down in the valley at that time. And this does suggest that, contrary to the idea of the Yahi as always having been cut off and isolated from the rest of the world, that they may indeed have had contact and interrelationships with neighboring tribes.
Your book, Ishii's Brain, reveals the story as much as you knew about it and were able to capture and put down in print of Ishii's life and his people's life. But you also weave through the story of what happened to Ishii's body and his brain separated from his body after his death and the eventual repatriation.
Most of what we'd known about Ishii had to do with his life in the wild and the whole story of how he had managed to survive for so many decades, and then his life in San Francisco and how he had lived in the museum for 5 years in San Francisco until his death in 1916. But it turns out that there was a whole part of the story that for many years was unknown, that nobody fully understood or knew about. And this is the fact that after he died, Ishii, and this was very much against his wishes, had an autopsy performed on his body, and his brain was removed and pickled as a kind of grotesque specimen for scientific study.
How did that occur?
Well, the story is a complicated one. Alfred Kroeber, the founder of the UC Berkeley Anthropology Department and Ishii's main guardian in San Francisco, was away in New York when Ishii died in March of 1916. And a couple of other people in San Francisco who had been caring for and looking after Ishii decided in the end that, contrary to Kroeber's wishes — Kroeber didn't even want an autopsy to be performed — that Ishii's brain should be removed and that an autopsy should also be performed on Ishii to take measurements of his body. It's paradoxical, I think, that the person who appears to have been most behind the preserving of Ishii's brain and the dissection of his body, again, against Ishii's own wishes, was a doctor named Saxton Pope. Pope was a famous surgeon at the time at the UC San Francisco Hospital. He was a very handsome, outgoing man who had many talents, was a violin player and an amateur musician and a doctor to Gene Harlow and other movie stars who would come up to see him from Hollywood. And Pope had struck up a kind of friendship with Ishii. They would go out and walk together in Golden Gate Park, and they particularly enjoyed shooting the bow and arrow together and would do target practice and go out hunting together. And when Ishii died, Pope, on the one hand, felt was devastated by his friend's death, but at the same time, he believed that a record should be made of Ishii's body, that Ishii was a unique kind of specimen as the last member of his tribe, and that therefore his brain should be cut out and saved against Ishii's own wishes. One of the paradoxical things then, or the ironies of what happened, is there was actually a person who cared in his own way a great deal about Ishii, who was responsible for the fact that his brain was pickled and preserved.
What does the study of Ishii and his people tell us about ourselves now?
Well, I think in a way, the ways that our images of Ishii and our understanding of Ishii and his story have changed reflect the way that America has changed and that our own understandings of ourselves and of others have changed. Back in the 1850s and 60s, when the West was being forcibly settled by white pioneers, there was this idea of Ishii's Yahi people as the evil, bloodthirsty redskins who had to be exterminated or removed to reservations.
But was that idea limited to the Yahi?
No, it was. This is one of the too often forgotten parts of the history of California, namely the fact that California was home to almost 500 different Indian groups speaking more than 100 different languages, and that with the Gold Rush in 1849 and with the settlement of California by Anglo pioneers, that a pretty massive campaign of extermination and removal was waged against tribes throughout, especially Northern California. This is a time when some counties offered bounties on Indian scalps, including in Mendocino, among other places, when Indians were rounded up and sent to reservations, and when what today I think we'd call paramilitaries, in other words, armed groups of Indian hunters would head up to the hills in search of Indians. So in a way, that what happened to Ishii and his people is really symbolic of what happened to a lot of Indian peoples in that very violent time in the first years of statehood.
Is there more to this story that is not yet revealed? Indications of the meaning of Ishii's life and of his songs, considering that we only have two eyes as the window into this culture?
Well, my sense is that research about Ishii and about that moment in the history in California will continue. There's still important work going on by linguists who are trying to figure out the full meaning of some of Ishii's songs. There's new research that's being done into the history of white Indian relations in the 1850s and 1860s up in the hills above the Sacramento Valley. So I think that Ishii is likely to remain an object of curiosity, a figure who people are interested in and want to know more about. My own feeling, though, is that there's always a part of Ishii that will remain unknowable and ungraspable. There are these gaps in the story. There are these things, again, what his name was among them, that I don't think that we'll ever really figure out. And I think in a way that one of Ishii's appeals over the decades, one of the reasons why he's fascinated people so much, is precisely because there are these mysteries about him, these things that we can't quite know. How exactly did he manage to hide up in the canyons of Northern California for so many years? Remember, this is Ishii and perhaps a couple of others are hiding just 10 or 15 miles from the town of Chico, California, which has a Sears Roebuck, which has electric lights, which has cars and a baseball team.
And this is in 1910, 1911.
This is in the first decade of the 20th century. And yet here is this group, this small group, these last holdouts of the conquest of North America. Alfred Kroeber called the Yahi the last free Indians in North America. I'm not sure I entirely agree with him in the sense that Ishii and his people were not exactly free. They were on the run and in hiding. But I think that there is this dimension of drama and mystery to the story that's likely to make it one that people are going to continue to ponder and to try to make sense of in years to come.
Tell us about the communication, the language that was developed between Ishii and Alfred Kroeber and the others at the Anthropology Museum in San Francisco while Ishii was living there.
Well, the anthropologists had worked earlier on with several speakers of the Northern Yana language, which was a language quite closely related to Ishii's Yahi language. They were about as different as French to Spanish. And in the first weeks in San Francisco, an old Northern Yana man named Sam Botwee was brought down from Redding as a translator for Ishii. He apparently really couldn't understand everything that Ishii said, but again, the similarities between their two languages were about that between Spanish and French, say, and Botwee was able to do some valuable translating. The anthropologists really never learned Yahi. They really never learned to speak Ishii's language. It was really Ishii who did the adapting and the learning.
He learned English.
He learned about 250 words of English. He knew enough English to make himself understood, to have conversations. He didn't have a big enough vocabulary to speak in detail and in nuance in the kind of way that he would have in Yahi. There are some wonderful stories about Ishii. And one of the things that he used to do was just walk around the neighborhood, around the museum of Parnassus Heights, and he would stop and visit with people there. He was a well-known neighborhood character, and one woman, old herself now, recalls how Ishii would sometimes stop by and sit on their stoop on one of those hilly San Francisco streets with this woman's old grandmother. And this old woman would have, and Ishii would have, quite animated conversations with Ishii and his 250 words of English and this old white woman who apparently was hard of hearing and had a hard time understanding even people who spoke perfect English. And yet the image of these two people, of this older woman and of Ishii chatting and enjoying each other's company. So Ishii did learn enough English to communicate and to navigate in the white world.
Oren Starn, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
One terrific book that I just finished is Anne Fadiman's When the Spirit Catches You, You Fall Down, which is a book about a Hmong child in the Central Valley of California. It's another story, like the story of Ishii, that's very much a story about California, and in this case about the conflicts and attempts at mutual understanding between Hmong immigrants in the town of Merced and the white doctors there that are trying to save a Hmong child. I found this both a beautifully written book and also a really interesting and sensitive reflection about the issues of cross-cultural conflict and understanding.
Oren Starn, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you.
Oren Starn is the author of Ishii's Brain, In Search of America's Last Wild Indian. The book that he recommends is When the Spirit Catches You, You Fall Down by Anne Fadiman. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available for $10 each. Our address is Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541, and the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Join us again soon for another edition of Radio Curious.